Good morning, everyone. Bruchim Abayim.
Thank you, everybody, for joining us. This is the conclusion of a very special weekend of learning with our special guest, Rabbi Dr. Ari Sitner. And this morning, we are excited to share a conversation with two additional guests, well, one host and one guest. So I'll just introduce our participants very briefly. Thank everybody for coming. Special thanks to the Friedmans for making this whole weekend and this whole project possible. Rabbi Shmuel Shuman is the CEO of the Hebrew Theological College, which... Bless. And he's also a presenter for many chasanim and kalas in the areas of preparing for marriage and building skills to create a healthy shalom bayis, which is the specific angle that he's going to be sharing with us this morning. Yanki Greenberger, many of us know from his active role in our community as the driving force behind Madregos on the professional side, you could say, right? A driving force. Madregos Midwest, in terms of working with youth across the spectrum of our community to addressing their needs and making sure that they can develop as a self-fulfilled individuals, both on a general level and also, of course, on a Yiddishkeit level. And so we are excited that they're joining Rabbi Sitner. Rabbi Dr. Ari Sitner, in addition to being the Center for the Jewish Future at Yeshiva University's Director of Community Leadership and working with communities and lay leaders across the country, and in addition to being a kidney donor and an important participant in our kollel in terms of developing the kollel behind the scenes over the course of many years, his other professional expertise as someone who has a master's and also now a PhD in social work and as a professor of social work at the Wurzweiler School of Social Work is someone who is focused on the mental health and the well-being of individuals. And so what we're going to focus on this morning is one aspect of our lives, of our well-being, that can help us improve ourselves both generally, but also in terms of our Avodas Hashem, Bein Adam La'atzmo, Bein Adam La'makom, Bein Adam La'chavero. And that is, we decided that we're going to focus this morning on the capacity for listening, the Koach Hashmia, which one could argue is that today, or certainly today, is something which is a much-needed skill in all of these Bein areas, the Bein Adam Le'atzmo in terms of developing ourselves, Bein Adam La'makom, Bein Adam La'chavero. You could argue, perhaps, that listening is the most important skill that we need to develop. Certainly in the world of learning, we have a Talmud Yerushalmi. The Yerushalmi, when it tries to bring a proof, when it cites something to support an argument, the Yerushalmi says, Tachazi, come and see. But in the Talmud Bavli, when the Gemara wants to bring a proof to something, it doesn't say Tachazi, it says Tashma. It says, come and listen. Because when you're living in Eretz Yisrael, and you have a greater measure of clarity, so you can see the Rabbono Shel Olam, you can see the proofs, you can perceive it in a particular way. But we're living in a time of gullus, when we're living in a time where we face more challenges. So it's difficult to see b'machshakim oshivani. So the Gemara says, Zeh Talmud Bavli. So we need to hone our listening skills to be able to grow as people and to grow as Avdei Hashem. And that's going to be ultimately what we come back to at the end of every day, at the end of a person's life. We come back to the Shema Yisrael. And that Shema, that listening, it's not just hearing, it's really listening. So it's our opportunity this morning to listen, to do some active listening, to some thoughts on how do we develop our own Koach of Shmiah, our own ability to listen. And so we're going to begin just with a few opening remarks, first from Rabbi Shuman, and then from Yanki, and then from Rabbi Dr. Sitner. Bavakasha.
Welcome, everyone, for joining us here. We appreciate you being here. So one of the things that I've done over the years is to give classes. Actually, it's not for chasanim and kalas as much as for married couples. Chasanim and kalas are usually listening to each other pretty well. You know, it gets the later on times where you have to make sure you can continue to mechazek those listening skills. People are married for longer periods of time. So listening is one of those areas which we spend a good part of the workshops focusing on doing some exercises. I think everybody will agree that listening is critical to successful relationships. I know that my Rebbe, Rav Yaakov Weinberg Zatzal from Ner Yisrael, was my Rebbe. He was very, very particular and machbig on his Talmidim, his close Talmidim, certainly, that they listen well. You know, and no one wanted to hear from him, you know, you're not a Shemeya. You know, if you heard that, that was very hurtful, you know, if he would ever, like, kind of want to say that to you. So you knew listening was very important in that relationship. And it really comes from Pirkei Avos. We talk about the Mem Ches Devarim. Shatorah Niknas Bahem, things that the 48 ways that Torah can be acquired. Number two on that list is Shmiyas HaOzen. That is that ability, right after Talmud, in fact, learning, is Shmiyas HaOzen, is listening. That's a critical skill to acquiring Torah, really acquiring a lot of good things in life, certainly with relationships. So I want to focus on one of the great listeners of the Jewish people and learn a little bit from him, specifically his Talmidim. Great listener I'm referring to is Hillel. Hillel, we know from many stories, was a great listener. Can't go into it right now. But I want to focus on his Talmidim, Beis Hillel. So the Gemara in Eruvin says that the halacha is like Beis Hillel. Okay, Bas Kol came out and said, Eilu ve'eilu dibrei Elokim Chayim, both Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel are words of the living God. But the halacha is like Beis Hillel. So the Gemara wants to know why. What is it about Beis Hillel that the halacha should follow them? So the Gemara says really kind of three areas. It says, Mipnei shenochin va'aluvin hayu. They were easygoing and they were patient. Number one, they're midos. They were patient and easygoing. V'shonim divreihem v'divrei Beis Shammai. They would learn and darshan and explain not only their words, but the words of Beis Shammai as well. They would really delve into understanding their opponent and what they were saying. And finally, below, oh, not only that, Ela shemakdimim divrei Beis Shammai l'divreihem. They would actually say what Beis Shammai said and paraphrase and say what they said before Beis Hillel would then give their own opinion. So what's fascinating is that the halacha follows Beis Hillel not because of their cognitive skills or their acumen or their IQ, but basically because of their good temperament and their good listening skills. I'm going to explain. So being patient and being gentle, okay, that makes for good listening. And people want to share their thoughts and ideas with somebody who's patient, who's gentle. Okay, it invites them more comfortable talking to such people. Then they would pay attention and study the words of Beis Shammai. They took them seriously. Rashi says there in the Gemara, Eruvin Yud Gimel, Lohaya Kal Be'enehem. They didn't just treat what Beis Shammai said lightly. They took it seriously and studied and analyzed and wanted to hear what did they say. Make sure they had clarity in that. And then finally, they would first mention Beis Shammai's words before their own words, which means they really heard and they understood the words of Beis Shammai, would paraphrase before saying their own piece. So what's the result? Halacha kebeis hillel. They have the final word in halacha. Because of that listening and understanding and trying to understand what their person who they were arguing with and discussing, what they were really saying, and giving that the proper respect and weight that it deserved before responding and before saying their own opinion. Halacha is beis hillel. But good listening is not only done with one's ears, with one's entire body. And there's something instructive we learn about. We learn from ears, Shmiyas HaOzen. So I heard this in the name of Rav Aaron Feldman from Ner Yisrael, that if you notice that of the five sensory organs, the ears are the only one that involves input, but not output. Taking in information, receiving sound, but they don't give anything out. So for example, right, the mouth takes in food and taste and speak. The nose takes in smell and breathes out. The eyes takes in images into the retina, which forms a picture. But the eyes also give out information. They have the concept of staring daggers. The eyes give out and output information. The hands, of course, receive stimuli, and they involve action. But the ears simply receive. They take in sound. And that's the art of listening. The art of listening is total receiving and internalizing what the other person is saying. And to do that involves a number of things. And I'm going to say six things here that good listening involves, before handing it over to my colleagues over here. So number one is looking at the person, focusing, eye contact, being attentive, showing that you're really focusing on that person. You know, for example, my wife and I, when we first got married, so we go to a restaurant, And it wasn't always a pleasant experience because I was always would sit like looking towards the door so I could see who was coming in, who did I know, who could I talk to. And she would say, you know, are you here for me or are you here to see other people? So from then on, we have a minhag that we go to a restaurant, we go to the back of the restaurant, and I always face the wall, okay? Because I wasn't so good at this. But looking and focusing and that eye contact is critical. Body language that shows you are internalizing what the other person is saying. This could be nodding, facial expression, leaning in, right? Posturing. Also, let someone know that you're listening to them. Not that you're just getting your words ready when the other person stops talking. Okay, so internalizing. Next thing is remaining silent, not interrupting, letting the person finish their thought, even though you already disagree with what they're saying. Okay, I saw Rav Noach Weinberg writes in the book 48 Ways of Wisdom is that the word listen and silent are the same letters. Listen and silent are the same letters. So something to that. The next thing is time. Giving it the proper amount of time. To hear them out, to be machshiv, what they're saying, needs time. And you have to give a person the proper time. That's what Beis Hillel did. Gentle. And they were easygoing. And they were patient. Okay, which lets a person know that you're not rushing them. Nochin ve'aluvin. Number five. To engage in ensuring that you heard correctly and understood their message. So ask clarifying questions to make sure you heard correctly, that you understood. That validates a person by showing that you really want to make sure you understand them. That's what Beis Hillel did. Shonin divrehem v'divrei Beis Shammai. They really, really tried to understand what Beis Shammai was saying to machshiv them. And then one of the exercises we would do in our marriage workshops is repeating what the other person would say and paraphrase it. So for example, you'd say, so what you're saying is, or what I heard you say is the following, and you restate it, is that correct? And then the person will say either it is correct or no, yes, but, okay, but then that shows again that you really are trying to understand what they're saying. And that was Beis Hillel. Beis Hillel is lo'od ela shamak dimim divrei Beis Shammai ledivreihem. They would be able to proceed and to hear out and paraphrase what did Beis Shammai say before then offering their own opinion. So, and then the final thing, number six, is that once you have really listened, you've really listened and done these things, do not respond in a manner that undermines your good listening. So don't judge the person's feelings. Don't try to talk them out of their feelings. Oh, it's ridiculous for you to feel that way. You know, so don't start judging and trying to talk them out of it. This is a famous thing from Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, John Gray, is don't try to fix the problem, okay? It makes a person feel like, you know, you don't really care. What do you mean? I'm just telling you what you should do. Here's your problem. Here, I'm going to fix it. Don't try to fix the problem right away. And then also, don't give advice unless you're asked for it. Okay, it's much better to say, well, what do you think you should do in this situation? How would you handle it? So if we can summarize and then turn it over to everyone else, is that the things I just spoke about, the six things, are Roshei Tevos, listen. Okay, let's go through them. L, look. Look at the person when you're speaking, give proper eye contact. I, internalize. Try to really internalize what they're saying with body language and making sure you're really bringing it in. S, silent. Okay, listen quietly till the person finishes without interrupting. T, time. Give the person the right amount of time that makes them feel that you're not rushing them. E is engage. Right? Really try to engage and understand what their message is and what they're saying. And finally, the last letter of listen, N, is non-judgmental. Not to judge them, not to try to talk them out of what the way they're feeling, and including that also is not try to give quick fix advice and make them feel that they're not being listened to.
So, I've been asked to kind of speak about listening with teenagers, adolescents, and I think to before you get in there, we have to realize what that creature of adolescence are, because without understanding that, we miss the boat. So adolescence, the whole developmental stage of adolescence is this identity-creating process where they're developing into their own person, where it bridges me and my parents to me and myself. And there's going to be a search for self-identity in adolescence. And what's going to happen is there's going to be exploration, there's going to be trial and error, there's going to be judgments and decisions that are made that we may agree with and some that we may not agree with. There are going to be mistakes, pushing limits, more mistakes and some really stupid mistakes along the way, but that's just the beast of adolescence. And most people in this room, as positive or negative as your teenage years may have been, would not want to repeat your teenage years. I think that's safe to say. So the whole process of adolescence is to really help foster this ability to create an identity for themselves. So as they're trying to do this, they're going to make decisions as to what you can handle. And kids will only tell you what they believe you can handle. They're not going to tell you things that they think that if you're going to get too emotional or it's going to hurt you, they're not going to tell you. So if you present with high emotions, they're going to tell you less information. If you present with less information, they'll tell you more information. If you present with less emotion, they'll tell you more information. And the reason they do this is because kids also want to protect their parents. They don't want to hurt their parents. They don't want to, you know, do things that are going to damage their relationship. So they're doing this in a way to protect, but it's done out of real concern for the parent, which is kind of an interesting dynamic. In a situation where there may have been some level of victimization, some inappropriate behavior that has happened to them, it needs to be said that the kid needs to be believed. As you know, and what happens is that they anticipate that you're not going to believe them, right? That's just like it's a defense mechanism. And our defense mechanism is to kick into denial that anything happened to our kid. So it's a perfect shidduch, as they say, right? It's a perfect shidduch of they're not going to believe me, and I don't want to really believe that this happened to my kid. Not because we're not concerned about them, just it's really heavy and hard to hear that something terrible happened to our kid. So it's important to be aware that this is a dynamic that's playing out inside, and we have to kind of rise above this with being conscious of the fact that they're anticipating not being believed, and our immediate reaction is to go into denial that anything happened. So if we're conscious of this, we can allow ourselves to believe them, even though there's a part of us that doesn't want to believe them. So the trick to getting your kid to talk is to listen. And you do that by listening to them, right? And what does that mean? That means you're not reacting to what they're telling you, right? So we want to listen to them and not react to what they're actually telling you. And there are two popular mistakes that parents make when they're engaged with their child. One is that the parent is parenting and therefore listening out of fear that the kid is going to go off the derech, or the kid is going to, you know, do something that's not, you know, that's going to make us think that there's something wrong with the child. So parents will do one of two things. Either they'll freeze up and they'll get this like blank stare on their face with total flat affect. Right? And the kid, you know, and they don't know what to do. Or they'll start confronting and becoming confrontational and challenging the kid, which is basically what happens to us when we have a panic attack, this fight or flight response. Right, we're either going to go and attack, or we're just going to like get out. So we can't get out when our kid is talking to us, so we'll just kind of like disassociate in some way. So when parents fear, and then therefore listen out of, if they parent out of fear that something is wrong with their child, something's going to be wrong with their child, or my kid is going to go off the derech, then that's something that we have to reassure ourselves that not necessarily. The other mistake that parents do is they feel this need to imbue and impart all their wisdom of the many more years of life experience that they have, right? And while we do have our life experience, we do all that stuff, their kid is, again, trying to figure out his own life or her own life. So listening is taking a step back and trying to not get as emotional as our anxieties want us to get. So, you know, kind of what Rabbi Shuman was talking to, the listening, you know, not necessarily having to say something, the oh and hmm, oh, oh, oh. You know, all those, you know, it's called crests, right? Those are the best responses because it keeps them talking without us trying to stick in our way or just like kind of nodding or, you know, the real active listening of just being there and listening to what they're saying. But when they say something that's really stupid, if I can say that, right? I can say that S word in here? Right?
I don't know why.
Yes, it's fine.
Right. I think I heard it once. So if they do, if they're kind of, when you're listening to them and they're saying something that's kind of really like stupid and you know it's not going to end well if they kind of go that, so guiding them to help them figure out their path by asking the questions or the comments or their thought process that you know is going to be detrimental to them, just ask the questions and let them try to like piece it together. Let them try to understand themselves and why they're thinking this thing. And but just asking the questions, but not, you know, in a... in an open way where they feel like you're on their side and not trying to, you know, counter them. And the more you're able to control your emotions, and I keep going back to this because this is the most important piece, the more you're able to control your emotions, the more present you will be, right? And the more present you'll be, the more you'll be able to fully listen. And the more you're able to listen, the more the kids will be willing to talk. And our children don't need to be clones of us, as awesome as we all are, right? If our kid turned out to be half of us, then they'd probably be in trouble. But they don't have to be clones of us. And part of their own development is to really find their own meaning in life, their own purpose in life. And we have to encourage and embrace that. And they'll also follow our lead if they see that we are genuine and not hypocritical with what we say and what we do. And that's always tough because sometimes our words don't always match our behaviors, and sometimes it's not that black and white situation. There's like a gray area why, you know, the whole discussion of why is it okay for adults to drink but kids can't drink, right? So we tell our kids you can't drink, but you know I'll make kiddush on wine or you know maybe have a l'chaim by something, but why can't the kid drink? So there is this gray area where. You know where these kind of get confusing. So it's really about having that type of relationship where what seems to be hypocrisy can be discussed and worked through. But ultimately, if we're as less hypocritical as possible with our messages that we give our kids and the behaviors that we do, they would be able to respect. And go with us in our conversations that we're having with our kids. That's an important piece of the conversation. Sometimes we get caught in the trap of, again, talking to our kids versus with our kids. And the last thing I want to mention also, which is about listening. So Rabbi Shumi talked about you know, being an active listener, how to be present. But the other thing is how do we know if our kids are listening to us, right? And the way to do that also is with body language, especially in the era of text messaging, where having conversations and tough conversations with people is becoming a lost art. So the body language tells you a lot of what you need to know. So if a kid crosses his arms, right, that's likely that he's shut down. Or if you're talking with them and they kind of turn, you know, away, that's a message that you've lost them. Whereas if the Rabbi Shumi mentioned, like, you know, when you're listening to someone, to like lean forward, right? So if the kid is leaning forward, that means they're with you, right? Or if they just seem kind of like very relaxed, that's also a sign. So if you're talking and you see the arms crossing, or they're kind of like turning their feet or their body away from you, that means that they're most likely shutting down. But if you see them engage leaning forward, seeming very relaxed, you know, even with their legs crossed and leaning back, that's a good sign that they're present. And I'll tell you one of the coolest experiences I've ever had with working with a kid. And I'm not professing to be a body language expert, but it was a kid that I had a relationship with, and he came into my office once, and for 45 minutes he didn't talk. He just moved his body, and I kept saying, Is it your father? Did he yell? No. And just using his body, I had a session with him for 45 minutes. It was the coolest thing I've probably ever done. So of course I'm going to tell it to you because I want you to know the coolest thing I ever did. But we were able to have an entire session with just his body language, and he didn't say a word. And at the end of the session, he actually got up and said, "No, that's why I like coming here," and he left. And I thought that was very cool. I think with kids, it all goes back to realizing that all they're trying to do is figure out who they are, and what their strengths are, and what can they provide this world. And as long as we understand that if they're thinking about something or just, you know, talking out loud, brainstorming, and it's the most frightening thing that they're saying, unless that they're really saying things about hurting themselves and, you know, some real dangerous behaviors, I think we have to take those very seriously. We have to believe them, and we have to be present with them. But at the end of the day, most healthy kids are just trying to figure out who they are. And when we listen to them with that understanding, first of all, it helps us just kind of calm down, because again, we have to keep our emotions in check. We can help them figure out who they are and who they want to be, and be pretty awesome people. So thanks for letting me share.
Thank you. Thank you to both my esteemed colleagues. Thank you, Rabbi Brand. I just want to say for the record that so I have the privilege of working with Rabbi Brand closely from my office at Yeshiva University, in offering kind of back office support to the Kollel. But one of the things Rabbi Brand doesn't know is that probably every 2 to 3 months my phone rings, and it's a community, pick any region in the country, constantly getting this call. "Hi, Rabbi Sitner, I understand you work with the Chicago Kollel. I'm calling from X. What would it take for us to be able to create our own Chicago Kollel in fill in the blank?" And so, of course, I walk them through what's involved, and they say, "Great, can we do it?" And I kind of say, "It's only one problem. We only have one Rabbi Brand." So it really is not something that's easy to replicate. No matter what resources a community has, what the Chicago community has, and the treasure that is Rabbi Brand, and the Kollel, the board of the Kollel, the members of the Kollel, the families, the supporters, it's really a very complicated but dynamic enterprise that really works together in a way that's an inspiration not only to this community, but to Klal Yisrael at large. And that's the beautiful vision that I get to see at Yeshiva University, and I just want to share that with you. So you really can't talk about listening without also talking about speaking, about communicating. That's the other side of that coin. So Chazal tell us that, you know, of all the species that Hashem made, so what sets humans apart from every other animal is the gift of speech. The fact that we can talk and communicate and articulate, that's inherently a human quality. So what happens, therefore, if I'm speaking to you and you're not hearing what I'm saying? What that means is you're essentially robbing me of my humanity. It's not just, oh, our marriage will be in conflict because we haven't resolved this issue. I feel less of a mensch, less of a person, because I'm talking and talking and it's not going anywhere. And that is the defining characteristic of what makes me who I am. And so I think it's important to start off that listening is going to be half of what we have to work on, and the other part is how we speak. And the two are going to go hand in hand. And I had the great privilege in my doctoral research to study and survey and analyze data that we collected from 242 from Orthodox individuals that divorced. And it was an incredible data set that gave us thousands of data points to understand what's going on in the Frum family when a marriage breaks down, when a couple separates, when they get divorced. Who do they turn to? Do they go to their rabbi? Which kind of a rabbi? Do they go to the Rebbetzin, the Mashkiach, the Rosh Yeshiva? Do they go to a therapist? Do they talk to their friends? Which of those factors of support are going to be most influential in building their resilience, in measuring their post-divorce outcome well-being? So we've got an amazing amount of data, but one particular piece that I want to share with you is that when we looked at asking the couples or the individuals, what was it that contributed to the end of your marriage? And there are multiple factors for each and every individual, but here's what we found. And these are a little bit shocking. Maybe they shouldn't be, maybe they should be. 17% of those who divorced said that within their marriage, there was sexual addiction. 23%, these are from families, it was infidelity. So about a quarter of the people that are getting divorced, there's infidelity. 32%, about a third of the data set, reported physical abuse. 55% reported verbal abuse. As a matter of fact, tomorrow night, in conjunction with the Orthodox Union and Shalom Task Force, I'm presenting an online webinar directed towards community leaders, rabbis, rebbes, and educators, shul volunteers, for people to learn about some of this data and to learn about the role of abuse. So it's important for us to realize that the marriages that we have, we put so much from the moment a kid's born, we're worried about shidduchim. We've got to send them to the right schools and dress them the right way. We've got to make sure they get there. And then at the end of the day, we're seeing that there's actually some serious issues that we need to address. So I want to help raise awareness, start a conversation, make sure that we're proactively educating our children and our community leaders to know how we create safe spaces, create an address for people to turn to when any of these things are going on. But the number one highest rated factor that people reported as contributing to the downfall of their marriage is 57% said that there were communication problems. So maybe there wasn't, abuse and infidelity, but they couldn't have a conversation with each other without it turning into a fight. And when that happens, you really can't go anywhere with the relationship. So communication is really, it's the core. It's who we are, it's what sets us apart, and how do we do that in an effective way? If you're following in the Parsha yesterday or even the week before, the word Shema comes up over and over. Moshe wants to talk, he's afraid Paro's not going to hear him. Ech Yishma Paro Eli, I'm not going to be heard. And he talks to B'nai Yisrael, V'lo Shamu Moshe, they didn't listen to him. So this is a pattern, over and over. I'm talking, nobody's listening. What's the point? Why should I bother? And that's what happens in a marriage. And that's, as you were saying, what happens with adolescents, right? How many parents have said, I feel like I'm talking to a wall. Are you even listening? Can you take the earphones out of your ear? Can you at least acknowledge that I'm talking to you? Right? How often do parents feel like they're just an Uber driver because the kid's sitting next to them in the front seat with the earphones on texting and doing other things? Can we have a relationship? So you can't demand the relationship. I can't turn to my spouse and say, I want you to love me. That's not how it works. You have to build it. It's like a flame that you have to fan and nurture. And with the right amount of oxygen, but not smothering it, it ignites. And that's the finesse, the dance that happens within a relationship. The Chafetz Chaim once faced a dilemma in his community where the Polish government said, we're going to now start to enforce that every child who's being educated, it's mandatory now that they have to learn the Polish language. And the Chafetz Chaim said, the kids are learning Torah, they're learning in Yiddish. What are you going to sit and waste your time studying Polish? So he said, I'm going to go speak to the chief minister, and I'm going to try to appeal to him. We should be granted an exception. So he goes to the chief minister, and after an hour, he comes back, and he turns to his assistants, and they say, how'd it go? He said, great, Baruch Hashem. He listened, no problem, and we don't have to insist that our children learn Polish. Wow, that's wonderful. And then someone said, hang on a second. Chief Minister speaks Polish. You speak Yiddish. How did you have this conversation? And the Chafetz Chaim smiled. He said, you're right. He said, I went in there and I spoke with my heart. And in other words, when he saw the tears in my eyes, when he heard the authenticity in my voice, he understood that the place that this was coming from was true, it was deep, it was real. And we connected. And that's the dance of communication. To be able to find that space within us that we can speak to other people, and as was said, to look into their eyes, but to look deeper into their hearts, to show the vulnerability that you feel, rather than putting up the wall to protect, because as humans we want to protect ourselves. It doesn't feel good to be vulnerable. You put your vulnerability out there, someone's going to push your buttons, it hurts. I've been burnt many times. I don't want to be burnt again. So I'll be a tough guy. It's much easier. So too often people are communicating from a place what I would refer to as a power struggle. Nobody wants to lose the fight. And how do you go about winning? If I win, then my spouse loses. That means I'm married to a loser. Who wants to be married to a loser? And if I lose, I'm married to a bully. So Shalom Bayis exists in this space where it's not about winning or losing, it's about creating a harmony where the marriage wins. What does it mean for the marriage to win? So Lamashal, imagine the difference for a moment between playing a game of ping pong and having a catch. When you have a catch with somebody, I throw the ball to you, you throw it to me, is the object to try to get the other person to drop it? No, that ruins the game of catch. I'm going to throw it to you, you receive it. You throw it to me, I receive it. That is a healthy, effective game of catch. When you play a game of ping pong, neither one wants to receive it. You just want to keep sending it back to the other person. And when there's a power struggle within a relationship, it's ping pong. I don't want it. I'm going to keep slamming it harder and faster and back and forth because I don't want it. It's your problem. You take it. You take it. It's like make you lose. And if you lose, I win. It's not an effective marriage. If you can say what you feel, and I can catch and say, huh, I got you. Okay. Now may I, there you go, you caught it. And there's this interaction. That's the space that a couple is going to be able to communicate in a more effective way. So I remember I once got a call from my son's Rebbe, and he said, I don't mean to alarm you, but I have a concern about your son. I said, well, what is it? What's going on? He said, I really think you need to take him to an audiologist. I'm afraid he may be suffering hearing loss. That's really concerning. I said, I call his name over and over. He doesn't look up. He doesn't respond. I call on him. He doesn't say anything. And I'm really worried. So wow, okay, that's really concerning. So we take him to an audiologist with this top-notch specialist, and he runs a battery of tests. And he sits us down after to give us the results. So like, you're nervous. You sit in front of the doctor, and he says, okay, so I want to give you the reports of our findings. I'm like, yeah, well, what is it? He says, the good news, there's good news and bad news. He says, the good news is that your son's hearing is excellent and he doesn't have any hearing problems. The bad news is that he has a listening problem. So what's the difference between hearing and listening? So hearing is passive. You could be sitting and looking at me now, hearing what I'm saying, but listening is when you're actively, your brain is processing it, internalizing it, assimilating the information into your life in a way that it now will take root to develop these synapses in your brain and make connections. It becomes something meaningful. So I remember in my years, and Randy's here, remembers the days in Charleston. I was a rabbi in Charleston for a number of years. And during that time, I worked with a very diverse population. Most of the people that I worked with were not Shomer Shabbos, and beautiful neshamas that came to learn. And I'd say, come to shul, read in English, daven to God in English, don't worry about the Hebrew. So they'd open up to Shema, the one line that maybe they knew better than others, and it'd say, Hear, O Israel, the Lord, our God, the Lord is one. And I would talk to them about, you know, what does that mean to you? And they're like, I know it's important, but it just doesn't mean much. Hear, O Israel. Hear, what does that mean? I hear you. It doesn't move me. And so the Rashba explains something beautiful. The Rashba says that to fulfill Shema Yisrael, it's not hear, O Israel. He says it happens on three levels. The first one, yes, that is to hear. We got to let it in, but the second one requires understanding. Only after understanding and processing it do we get to the third level, which is Kabbalah. To accept it. To really incorporate and receive what the message is. And therefore, because I believe and I understand that there is one God, what does that mean? I give myself over. I submit to the Rabbono Shel Olam. That's a very powerful level. And I'll give you, by the way, a tool that will help you that you will never forget this, ever. You ready? The word Shema. The first step. Shh. Just got to be quiet so you can hear it. The next one. The understanding. What's the final one? Ah. The enlightenment. Shema inherently reminds us to listen, to incorporate it, and to be makabel what it is that we believe. Now, my question to you, and I know next time you say Shema, you'll be thinking about this, is that's great between Ben Adam Lamakom, me and God, I'm going to have that relationship. But am I supposed to apply the same paradigm to my marriage? That whatever my wife says, I should listen, understand, and then say, oh yes, of course, I'll accept and follow whatever you say. Is that what the Torah wants us to do by way of listening? Just to blindly follow? What about my opinion? What about my feeling? What about my autonomy? Doesn't my opinion matter? And so I would suggest the following. That the Kabbalah, the final step of what it means in a relationship, is not about blindly following and saying, okay, I have to do what my wife says. Although on many days that's a really, really good idea. But it means to be mekabel her perspective. She's throwing the ball, I'm going to catch it. It doesn't mean we're going to decide in the end that we're going to follow what she threw to me, but I'll catch it, I'm not going to let it drop. I value her opinion. I respect her perspective. I respect who she is. And once I'm mekabel that, we then begin the next phase of what the exploration of the conversation is. So the last part that I want to tie into all this is that it's not always easy to catch the ball. If you were riding a unicycle in the middle of traffic, would you be able to catch a ball that I throw you? Right? It suddenly becomes much more difficult. So is there anyone here in life who is not constantly multitasking? When you're in the car, but you're on the phone, but you're following the GPS, but you're trying to think about what you have to do next and what time mincha is, because you also have to stop at the store, but you have to make it later to it. The more mental processes we're running, the less we have to dedicate to the task at hand, and so we're not present. I might be on a date with my wife, and I'm at dinner, but my mind is elsewhere. I might be talking with my children, but I'm thinking about other things. I might be davening Shemona Esrei, but I'm thinking about all the things I have to do later. And so in the therapy that I do working with couples, I follow the minhag, if you will, of the great researcher, Doctors John and Julie Gottman of the Gottman Institute, where when we do therapy with couples, we actually have them wear pulse oximeters. Those little finger things they put on the doctor to measure your blood pressure, right? To see your oxygenation levels. Why? So the average resting heart rate of a healthy individual, let's say 70 beats per second. What happens if I'm having a conversation with you, but your heart rate is at 120? What does that tell you about what's going on internally? Most clinicians are saying, let's talk about the issue. How has your mother ruined your life, right? Let's talk about the problem that you have. Dr. Gottman said, wait a second, this pioneering research, if we could look at what's called, referred to flooding, fight or flight, that I'm so worked up and so incensed and enraged by what you're saying that you're not hearing me and my heart rate is my heart's pounding. What we find is that a person in fight or flight starts getting a tunnel vision. They can't hear. It's like riding that unicycle in traffic trying to juggle. It becomes impossible. And researchers have found that people in fight or flight, in this flooding stage, which is also known as diffuse physiological arousal, where they start suppressing the autonomic nervous system and they can't think straight, they start to repeat themselves again. And then they say a minute later the same thing, and then again, and then again. Why? Because they can't think openly. They can't think creatively. They're just sort of in this survival mode, and it's a very difficult place to be. So when a couple is fighting, and you start yelling and screaming and raising your voice, so no good's going to come of that argument. So what Dr. Gottman found is, let's take a time out. He'll actually say to a couple, okay, your blood pressure is, you know, high, it's beeping, we're going to go into the other room, take a magazine, and just read something for 15 minutes. And they come back down, and they start off the conversation where they left off, but it's like they're a new couple. They're calm, they're smiling. When a person is in a fight or flight, they lose their sense of humor. A couple that's engaged in this space of trying to hear each other, when you're flooded, you can't laugh. You can't joke. Even about a serious issue, when a couple can joke, it means that they've got their playful dynamic. They can work through a difficult issue because we need our sense of humor. If I may self-disclose, one of the most embarrassing things that I'd ever done as a rabbi was it was at a point at the end of my time in Charleston when I was moving on, and the job that I had lined up, I got a call that it fell through, the organization shifted, and I didn't have the job to go to. And the house that we had put a down payment on that we were going to move to, same day, also fell through. So I'm leaving, I don't have a house, I don't have a job. I get a text from someone in the community an hour later, and I was in the car, and I'm at a red light. I look at the text, and it says, it wasn't really a member of the shul, someone I knew. This is so embarrassing. He says, Rabbi, I wanted to let you know that my grandmother just passed away. And in my brain, I heard, okay, wow, life cycle thing going on in your life, whatever, right? I have a copy of the text. I saved it to remind myself of how serious flooding could be. I actually responded to this person. Wow, that's great, Mazel Tov! To which he responded, she died. Is that the worst thing, like, ever? I quickly called him. Oh, I sent the text. I was sending it to somebody else. I didn't mean that. I'm so sorry. When you're flooded, you are not thinking for yourself. Is that a place to navigate a difficult marriage conversation? To talk about your future, to talk about your stress and your finances and your kids and your in-laws? Go out to a Starbucks. Be in a calm space. Go for a walk. If it's getting elevated, then take a time out. And when you're a child and you're getting into that space of conflict, say, you know what, we're going to take a time out. I'm going to make you hot cocoa. Let's regroup in a few minutes. Because it's not about the power struggle. It's really about being able to enter that space of calm and listening physiologically to what's going on. So it's not just about the words, but my own internal process. And I'm just going to conclude with a quick little story. A few months ago, right after the Pittsburgh shooting, so in my work at YU and also in some of the work I do with Chai Lifeline, so I do trauma intervention. So within 24 hours of the shooting, I was in Pittsburgh, and I was responding to the crisis, bringing support to members of the community, to first responders, and I observed something that was fascinating. I went to Tree of Life Synagogue, and I stood out there for hours, talking to people, engaging. That night I go back to my hotel, and I'm standing in the lobby and I'm watching the TV, and news is playing. And I noticed that there were two different things happening. What I saw on the news, what the entire country saw on the news, were words like terrorist and homicide and mass shooting, and showing graphic pictures and scary images and very intense words, inflammatory ideas. My heart rate was literally, I felt my heart pounding in my chest seeing these scenes and hearing this. And then I stopped and reminded myself, wait a second. I was just there 10 minutes ago. You know what I saw? The scene was, there were candles burning. You smelled in the air the scent of the candles, the scent of the flowers, thousands of flowers. It was silent. Strangers were coming and hugging, praying, laying down notes and cards. It was the most healing scene I've ever been to in my life. So peaceful, so beautiful, so supportive. And the image I saw on TV was the exact opposite. And so often you can have a scenario in life where the scene will be decided based on the reality that each person will create. And we don't necessarily know what the experience is for another person. Maybe you just had a really bad day. And I'm coming into this conversation and I'm having a great day. And I don't know where you are emotionally. And I think it's important to just be sensitive to the larger context, to know the narratives that are also going on in our head. I'm stressed, I'm worried, I have deadlines, my work, my job, whatever it is. Just be aware of it. Introduce the conversation. Before we talk, I just want to let you know I had a really stressful day. Things are going tough, things are bad. Bring that into the picture. Create a reality that becomes a shared reality. And from that, not only live these examples of healthy communication, but model them and be able to demonstrate for our children. That's the greatest gift you can give a kid, is an example of what a happy and healthy marriage looks like. Thank you very much.
So maybe just one follow-up question before we conclude, which is that a lot of these ideas are new, and a lot of them are well-worn. For different people, some of them are they're new, and some of them they're accustomed to. If somebody has a particular MO, so what are some strategies to break out of that, whether it's in a couple's context or in a child context or in a friend context? You know, we've always been doing it this way for so long. How do we create the opportunity to start again? Maybe everybody can chime in if you want.
So I think the first step of the 12 steps is that we admit that we're powerless over our fill in the blank, and our lives become unmanageable, right? You know, owning up that fact that what I'm doing is not working. So I think if we're able to, you know, kind of take a step back and say, you know what, I have, you know, the relationship I have with my kids is not a open, you know, dialogue filled conversation with my kid. I have to change, because as the parents and as the adults, we're the ones who are responsible. We're the ones who have to take ownership over what's going on. So I think that we have to look at ourselves and say, you know, I need to do something different. And I think it's okay. There may be an exception. Well, there never and always are two words you should always never say, right? So there may be an exception. But I think I'm a fan of parents owning up to their mistakes and being able to have a conversation with the kid and say, you know what, I've been going about our relationship and our conversations a little bit wrong. I want to try to do things differently. So I think Rabbi Schumann talked about time, giving time. A lot of times, kids will bring up the issues when you don't have time. Right, that's the way of kind of like getting it out there and go. So I think to be able to kind of go back and say, you know what, I want this is so important. I want to hear more about it. And as opposed to having the rushed conversation that you would normally have just to kind of get it over with, because like Dr. Sidney was saying, we have so much going on, is to be able to come back and say, you know what, I want to hear this. I'll be back in 15 minutes or at the end of the day. Let's talk about it. But I think the first thing is recognizing that I, as the parent, need to change. I, as my role in whatever relationship it is, whether it's marriage or I, need to change. And we're creatures of habit, but we're also, my Rebbe always said that the difference between us and animals is that we can change. We're not solely run off of instinct and, you know, reaction. We can change, and that's the difference between us and animals. So.
Up there? Of course. I can just build on that. Is that there's no question you have to acknowledge the problem, that things aren't working. I think that education is very important, because a lot of times when these continual problems occur, you know there's a problem, but you don't know how to get out of that problem. How do you change the way you communicate? How do you understand each other better? And I think education is something that really, you need that extra help, and that can come in a couple of different ways. Obviously, there are people that are knowledgeable in these things that can direct a couple, or which again, what I've been working with, to understand how to better communicate. So let's communicate better. Well, what does that mean? We're not doing a good job of it. How do you do that? So there are people that are trained and they're professional. You know how to do this in a good direction. And there's also self-education. We'll tell couples, there's some really good books out there. That kind of Gottman, as was mentioned like by Sidner, is the Bible. There's a few of them. One particular one, which really talks about some of these things of flooding and fight or flight and the four horsemen. Understanding relations better, it really, really helps. The five love languages. Okay, I forget who's the author of that one. You remember? But that really, I know for me, it helped me really understand. How do you communicate? Or how do you love someone the way they want to be loved? It's not necessarily the way you want to show that love. As I mentioned, John Gray. So these books, I think, really help a person understand, yes, there's a problem, we're not doing it well, but we need help to know how to do it better, and there are resources out there to do it. I think it's important to take the opportunity to do that.
Thank you. So a couple of follow-up points, which is, how many of us go for an annual physical just because? Not because you're feeling sick, because you go. You go to the dentist because you're supposed to go. If you wait till you feel like you got a cavity, then you're going to have a bigger problem. And I just want to invite us to think about our relationships in the same way. And it could be a relationship with a child where it's a little bit strained because that kid is, it could be an adult child. It doesn't have to be an adolescent. An adult child where you feel like, I feel like we're growing apart. I'd love if we can go for family therapy, speak to our rabbi. Just somebody that can facilitate us working through why it is that we're not feeling as close as we used to or as we could. So to think both reactively when there is a problem, when you've got that cavity, but also preventatively, to go for that tune-up. A husband and wife, it's almost like a little mental, emotional day to retreat, a vacation for us to just speak to a couples therapist. Not because we have a problem. There are some amazing couples that have wonderful marriages that just go once a year just for a checkup, one or two sessions, talk about some issues that are building, and just diffuse some of that tension in a really healthy way. As Rabbi Shimon mentioned, to go for education, one of the things that I've started introducing in our community are the Gottman's workshop for the 7 principles that make marriage work. Another fantastic book. It's on Amazon. Everyone should read that book. It's research based. So it's not just, you know, shooting from the hip, here are nice things to try, but it's things that have been proven repeatedly to be effective to help couples build their ability to communicate. The next thing I just want to point out is put your phones away. Just put your phones away. And it's hard at shul. It's hard over dinner. It's hard when you're with your family. It's all, our lives are on there and we're constantly interacting with everybody. And so the quantity of communication is going up, but the quality is going down. We need to look into the eyes of the people we love and talk to them and to make eye contact. Our toes should be facing their toes when we're talking, not to the side, not halfway. Body language, right? Toes should be facing, eyes should be locked, shoulders should be square. You're the most important person in this moment in my life, and I just want to talk to you. And so we convey that when we're doing this, looking at the phone, Wait, I'm almost done with Candy Crush. I must beat this level, right? So we're not really engaged in the moment. So let's put the phones away. And the final thing I just want to say, which is somewhat related, but I've seen it with a number of my clients recently in the realm of parenting. Parents have anxiety about children, about their children's religiosity. Will my kid go off the derech? Will they stop observing mitzvot? Are they going to take their yarmulke off or stop wearing tefillah? Oh my God, my 14-year-old missed Marav this week, and I'm really nervous he's going to start eating treif because of it. Wait, what? So the parents have heightened anxiety. At a certain point, a teenager is a teenager. They're born to be lazy. They need to grow up. It'll happen. But it happens when you can give unconditional love and support to your child, to reward them when they're doing great, to support them when it's tough, and say, I know how hard it is to go to Marav. I'll drive you there. I'll wait for you. And then I'll take you out to Baskin Robbins afterwards because I'm so proud. You do that for a couple of years, they're going to develop a healthier sense of their own religious identity. But within that, it's critical to not crush a child's emotional well-being in light of their religious well-being. If you try to make a kid more religious but less whole, they're going to be neither. We would much rather a family work on developing and building up the child's emotional well-being to feel love and support, whole. And your kid's got, you know, ADD or OCD and depressed and anxiety. A lot of kids in with a lot of things today. The world is really changing. And phones, a lot of things are impacting why that is. But if we focus more on the kid just being loved, having an address at home that is safe, I'm not going to be the executioner for the teacher who calls up and says, you need to punish your kid because they came late to class. I say to the Rebbe or teacher, no, you need to punish them. When they come home, my job is to love them. And maybe they do something that deserves a punishment. Fine, we'll figure out a consequence. But that's your job. At home, the child needs to feel loved, needs to feel safe, needs to not feel judged, and to know that I make mistakes too. We all make mistakes. And if we can communicate that vulnerability and say that it's okay, you can talk to you about anything. And to bring things up to our kids about sex, about drugs, about, you know, all of the issues that we're worried about, avoiding the conversation is not going to minimize the chances of them engaging with them. When we talk about them is how we prepare them to say, I'm cool with it, we can talk about these things. So when you confront it and are challenged, that bridge of communication has been built, and then we can revisit it.
So I just want to thank you all, because this was incredibly enlightening. I certainly listened and gained a lot. I hope everyone did. Well, please, God, post it to share with others. Thank you all for coming. Thank you for making this entire weekend possible. And have a great day, everyone. Yeah, Shikoa.
Thank you again, Rabbi Shimon, for hosting. Thank you, Yanki.
Thank you.
Rabbi Sittner.
Thank you for partnering with us.
Always
so
great.
So many different ways.
Baruch Hashem.